With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. We have an absolutely bumper show today where we have not one but two interviews and all the usual pitches and Curzon Home Cinema recommends. There is only time for first names today. Hello to Sam.
Hello.
Hello to Ursi.
Hello.
I'm Harry. Let's move on with the pitches. Right, so we are talking about three different films today. So the pitch is as follows. If you could take three films and merge them to create one super film, what would that film be? Remember, you get extra marks for the title. And we're going to start with Ursi.
No, okay.
No!
So bad. Anyway, no, I'm good at pitching. I'm good at pitching. So my choice is going to be a little bit lowbrow, I have to say, but it's going to be a great, great film at the end. So I decided to merge three Nicolas Cage movies, because that's what they need.
Someone's won the points!
So I decided to go for Ghost Rider.
Okay.
Raising Arizona.
Yep.
And Bringing Out the Dead. And the movie itself is going to be Ghost Rider has had enough of being really somber and depressed, and decides that wherever he goes now, instead of rock and roll, he was going to have a yodeler at the back of his bike. And he was going to go out and go to orphanages all over the states and cheer up all the little kids. Until one time, he decides to steal one.
Oh.
And then it becomes his sidekick to battle the ghosts that are hunting him.
So do we approve of him stealing in this version of the film?
Well, he's the ghostwriter, so technically, whatever we do, he's going to do whatever he wants.
And just in case Nicolas Cage's agent is listening, is he going to get three separate checks still? Because he may or may not need the money, according to certain reports.
Well, I think after that, what was the movie that he did where the poster is him on a donkey looking for Osama bin Laden? I think after that movie, maybe he needs three separate checks.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, because that was not
what?
Good.
Okay,
what?
So
yes, that exists.
Wow.
Why didn't you pitch that movie?
Because it's already out. Somebody gave money.
Excellent. So have you got a title for
I do.
Film? Okay, what's the title?
Ghost Rider 3, Raising the Dead.
Oh, well played. A lovely start. Sam, we're going to move on to you.
Okay. So at the end of Die Hard, Hans Gruber falls out of a building and dies. Or does he? He
dun,
fakes
dun,
his...
Dun.
He, well, it turns out he faked his death, guys, okay? Uh-huh. And just went into retirement and has lived a quiet life up until now. So he's living in Florida, let's say. He runs a bar in Florida, Hans Gruber.
Why in Florida? You just...
It's just where old people go in America to retire, isn't it?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got a big question, but I'm going to let you finish your pitch.
Okay. Meanwhile, in an alternative dimension where wizards are real, Professor Snape has also faked his death and has gone into retirement, and he thinks he's done with the wizarding world.
Okay, I've got another question regarding that, but I'll let you continue.
He's done with the wizarding world, and he thinks the only way to sort of really relax is to go into a reality where there are no wizards. So he does that. But he's bored there being the only wizard. So he thinks, you know what? I'm just going to try and take this over. I'm going to try and take over the world. I'm a wizard. I can easily do it. And he does this. He clones himself. So there are many different Snapes now trying to... Wizard Snapes trying to take over the world. And Hans Gruber, he thinks, no, I'll sit this one out. Like, I'm retired. I can't get involved.
He's getting too old for that stuff.
He's getting too old, but he just... No, I just... I've just got to... I really need to do something. So he calls on his old nemesis, John McClane, to try and stop the Snapes. So the third film comes to play in the title. You ready?
Yep.
Die Hard 6, Rise of the Planet of the Snapes.
Nice. Well played.
Thank you.
I don't have anything in my notes to respond to that, so we're going to leave that there. Okay, my one is really simple. I basically worked backwards. I found one word that links them all,
mm-hmm.
and then created a plot around that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the word that links them all is iron. We have Iron Giant, the fantastic cartoon that is still fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
We have Iron Man, Tony Stark himself. We have the Iron Lady, Margaret Thatcher. This film creates one giant iron billionaire prime minister. The Iron Giant Man Lady. The twist is it tries to take over the whole world.
The world.
The world. And the only thing that can stop it are Labour backbenchers. Mickey Rourke.
Oh, I voted and, for him, I remember.
And
that.
Itself. Because the Iron Giant doesn't really have like a nemesis. It's sort of nemesis is itself.
Mm.
So then somehow the Labour backbenchers, Mickey Rourke.
Have their own Iron Giant.
And maybe Sir Ben Kingsley, if we can get him.
Sir Ben, why not?
Sir Ben. Maybe they have to convince the Iron Man lady to not take over the world and just take over Britain.
I have a question.
Okay.
Is the Iron Giant Man lady married to Jim Broadbent in this scenario as well?
I think the first thing that happens is it's about 25 minutes of a divorce scene between Broadbent.
I was hoping they'd just squash him.
That's how it ultimately ends,
right,
and
okay.
And that's why the Iron Giant Man Lady is so furious.
Yeah,
because it turns out if you kill your spouse, you don't get any of the money.
Loophole.
So it's a really difficult time.
Yeah.
For this giant being.
Well, impressive. I have no questions about that. That all
good,
makes sense
good.
To me.
Okay, lovely. I think I want to see the Nicolas Cage trio of films.
I want Iron Man Lady.
Snapes. I want to see Snapes.
We all vote for each other. That's all, nice.
Let's decide as host. Do I get the deciding vote?
I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm obviously going to go for the one I voted for. So Ursie wins the point.
Yay!
So
there we go. Hey, Weinstein's, I'm coming.
It's a
democracy.
It's a crooked system.
It is.
Anyway,
Crooked Harry.
The majority have won. Lovely. Before we get into the first review of the day, let me just tell you what we have coming up. So we have the documentary I Am Not Your Negro, where I have interviewed the director, Raoul Peck, and there will be a review from me and Ursie. We then have a new film called Raw, which Sam interviewed the director and will also be reviewing. We will also be previewing the new Pablo Larraín film, Neruda, and talking about some of the films on his collection on Curzon Home Cinema. So a lot of great stuff coming up. Excellent. So first up, we have I Am Not Your Negro, a documentary that revolves around Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King and their assassinations, all through the narrative voice of James Baldwin. I was fortunate enough to interview the director, Raoul Peck, the other day. Apologies, the audio might not be fantastic on this clip. But please bear with it. He was a really interesting guy and gave some really good insights into his view of James Baldwin, the film, and sort of how it came about. So enjoy that. So I am honoured to welcome Raoul Peck, director of I Am Not Your Negro, to the Curzon Film Podcast. Raoul, how are we doing today?
I'm fine.
You're fine.
Surviving.
You're fine. He's getting there. So what I really wanted to do is ask you first. It's obviously based on works of James Baldwin, but it's not based on one book or one particular piece of work by him. It's lots of different sort of, you even said, bits of notes and unfinished work. Do you mind just going in a bit more about how you kind of put this together and how you put this sort of documentary together?
Yes. Well, first of all, that's probably one of the rare instances where you start a film without knowing exactly what the film is going to be.
Yeah.
For me, the first item was, how do I bring James Baldwin back to the front line?
Yep.
You know, that was my motivation, that was the initial idea, without knowing exactly what kind of film it would become. I spent several years after I gathered the rights to find, you know, which would be the more efficient form.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a kind of freedom that you have, but that freedom makes it even more difficult.
Yes.
Because basically you just know the choice you're gonna make is gonna be definitive.
Yes.
So you're not formed. Some film subjects you know instinctively that it's gonna be a narrative or it's better as a documentary. For that particular subject, anything could go, and I just needed the most efficient one. And deciding to go for the documentary was key because I knew that first I could produce it myself, and I could take whatever time is necessary.
So you got freedom there.
Yes, I gave myself that freedom.
Excellent.
Because the one thing I knew is this is not a film that you can have. To have permanent discussion with anybody, even people that would, you know, be good about listening to. But I really needed that freedom because I had to overcome my own fragility or my own doubt about certain things.
Yep.
So, and for that, time is important, and also financial independence is important. So you don't want to have somebody on over your shoulder every 6 months coming, you know, Raoul, where is the film?
Yeah.
And then you have to carry on to make sure you finish the film when the film itself is not finished.
Yes. Yeah.
So I try to protect myself of all those possible threat or pressure.
Okay.
And then I slowly find the form, you know. It took time until I got my hands on those 30 pages of manuscript, of notes on Remember This House.
Yeah.
If I had rushed into making a narrative like I wanted, or a sort of mixed form like I wanted at some point, I would not have made the film the way I made
it.
Yeah. So time was in the essence. And and then I had a, through those pages, I had a very genuine, organic entry to Baldwin's mind.
Yes.
You know, basically, you know, a book that was not written.
Yeah.
And so you, as a filmmaker, you are going after that book, you know, and you have to piece that book together. And it's an incredible adventure.
Yeah, it must be.
You know,
be.
And but I could also claim that because I felt that I knew Baldwin very profoundly. You know, he was part of my life, basically all my adult life.
Yes.
You know, I read him very early on. So, you know, when I say the film took 10 years, but in fact, I should add it took the 30 years prior as well.
Great. So you said you started... You started becoming aware, you say in the introduction, because you've done a book version that goes with the film, and you said in the introduction of that, you sort of came to Bob when you were about 15, is that right?
Later, I think it was 17, 18, around that day.
So for a sort of UK audience that might not know James Baldwin, how would you sort of describe his impact, particularly in sort of the United States of America? How would you describe his sort of influence and where what he does?
Well, first of all, I would say they should read James Baldwin.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
That's the first thing. And I would recommend to read The Fire Next Time as an incredible book. People know now better Ta-Nehisi Coates,
yep.
Who have written a similar book, but The Fire Next Time is for me was a very important book for me to read as a young man. And why? Because he's again he was one of the rare human being, intellectual writer who really helped me understand the world I was living in. At the time there were not so many writers where you felt totally at home as a young black man.
Yep.
And Baldwin was that, even though he was not only important to young black men, but to a lot of young white men who were also looking for an explanation
yep.
of their life. And I've got a lot of feedback from people, from audiences who told me, you know, how Baldwin was key in their life.
Yes.
You know, white, young white men today, or older men telling me, yes, they also read Baldwin very early on in their life and that changed their life. Mm. So that's what Baldwin can do to you. And for me personally, he helped me structure my thoughts, structure my analysis. He helped me see the world as an incredible, I would say not mystery, but miracle.
Okay.
With all its contradiction.
Yeah.
There is a sentence I like where he said, you know, every human being is a miracle, and I try to respect and love that miracle that they are, and at the same time to protect myself from the monsters they have become.
Yeah. Okay.
So this tells you everything about Baldwin's
yeah.
philosophy.
Yeah.
And that's how I try to live my life through that philosophical motto, you know.
Right, because he says about Malcolm X during, and it's in the actual film, he says, this is a part of the quote, he tells them that they really exist, you know.
Yes.
Do you find the same with James Baldwin? Do you find James Baldwin has that message for you about existing
oh, yes.
in your place in the world?
Yes. Baldwin he has a way to speak to you, whether you are an intellectual or you are a worker or a woman or somebody with not a lot of education, because he finds the word that goes right through your minds and your heart at the same time.
Yeah.
He speaks to both, and you get that because he speaks from his own experience. You know, he takes himself as the element of analysis.
Yeah.
You know, he tells you about his own judgment about what he went through or what his family went through. So he's very convincing.
Yeah.
And there are not many people who can, you know, use language the way he does it. You know, for a young 14-year-old preacher, because he was a preacher at 14, you know, to be
yeah.
able to talk to adults about their soul, about their questions, about their fear
yeah.
of life. You know, to have done that when you were 14, you know, just armed with the Bible,
yeah,
the New Testament is incredible.
Yeah.
And I think that changed his life. And that's why he is able to change ours today. And the incredible thing is those things that at the time in the 60s when I read them were incredible, is that today they are still incredible.
Yes, yeah.
You know, that's the most weirdest aspect of it, you know. These words did not, grow old. They became even more relevant
yeah.
today. It's about, you know, every human being has to be responsible for its own life. You know, we can't go on like this and thinking that, well, I cannot do anything about my situation, whether I'm privileged or not. No, you have to find your place in your society and defend what you think is right to defend. And Baldwin just give you the whole analysis, put it on the table and ask you, you know, now it's your job. Whether or not you react to it, this is your responsibility. But you cannot say that you don't know anymore. Yeah. You can't pretend that you don't know, there is nothing to do, or it's not your fault. You know, we are all involved in that one history.
Yeah.
We are part of that unique history. There are not a multiply of history. Everything is linked. Whatever we do here in Europe or in London is linked to whatever we have done in the past or whatever we are doing right now in the, I don't know, in the Middle East, to take one example. You know, everything is linked. You know, our societies are linked.
Yeah, it's not separate. We're not all separate.
Exactly.
We're one sort of world.
So everything that happened have consequences, and we need to see those consequences and maybe try to make it better. But we can't go on, you know, everybody in its own little bubble. And it has gotten worse those last 30 years, where, you know, we became all, you know, two-person family and bubble, and maybe with a group of friends added to that. And we all have our iPhone or tweet and all that. And we think that we are communicating with the world, but we are not. In fact, our circle have become, you know, smaller and smaller, and we don't see that we are being cut from the reality of the world, and that's what makes problems harder to solve.
Okay, great. And in terms of, I just want to go slightly towards the narrative of the film, because I guess the main sort of narrative or the central, what seems to be the central part of the film is the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and Medgar Evers. Now, I think probably everyone in the UK has definitely heard of Martin Luther King and definitely heard of Malcolm X. But in terms of Medgar Evers, they might not have heard that name before. The film sort of starts with saying about these three really important men. How important is he within the sort of narrative of the whole film?
Well, that's incredible mind of Baldwin to reunite those three people who are three very different leaders.
Yes.
And Medgar Evers, of course, being the one that is less known because he was killed first and very early on, before the fight was so popular or so well known. But the intelligence of linking those three men gave us also three different aspects of the way the civil rights was perceived and still perceived, you know, because Medgar was active in the South. He was, you know, he started by, you know, doing inquiries and trying to bring people to vote.
Well, you see a bit where they tour around together, don't you?
Exactly.
See Baldwin and then touring
around
together.
Protests, yep. etc. And Martin Luther King was perceived as the preacher, the nonviolent preacher, until now, which is of course totally false, because the last 2 years of his life he was a very radical preacher. By the way, today is the anniversary of his famous speech that he made at the St. John the Divine in New York against the Vietnam War, where he said very strong words against the war and against poverty and the fact that the war was draining money from the country that they really needed, and they were killing people elsewhere. So this part of Martin Luther King, we want to forget. And the same, we want to keep Malcolm X as the racist torch that he was at some time, and forget that in the later years of his life, before he was killed, he had distanced himself from the Nation of Islam. That he became a statement, that he became, he had lived, left the race issue to come to a class issue, to a real analysis of his society, and that both became closer
together. We say that in the film, and I think
that's the aspect we don't want to remember.
Yeah.
You know, that's and that was the genius of Baldwin. To put that back on the table.
And to show it.
And to show why those men were dangerous for the system.
All right, fascinating. Thank you. That's all we've got time for.
All right.
But thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you.
Excellent. So that was Raoul Peck talking to me just a few days ago. And let's jump straight in to the review, I guess. So, Ursu, what were your initial thoughts when you watched this?
I've studied the civil rights movement mostly in school and university, like a lot of people might have, and I recently saw as well the Oscar-winning documentary O.J. Made in America as well.
This was Oscar nominated as well.
This was, yeah. And this, I'm Not Your Negro, is a completely different kettle of fish, in my opinion, because James Baldwin is credited as the writer, but obviously did not contribute to this documentary physically. So they took his unfinished manuscript, Remember This House, and they layered his prose over clips of different phases of American history with regards to race relations and slavery. And I thought it was one of the most interesting films. I can't even describe it as a proper documentary because I don't think it actually tries to be a documentary. I think it tries to be a feature film, really. And
I think that's what that's what Raoul Peck sort of said when I was talking to him, that he didn't want it just to be one thing and be pigeonholed and forced to go a certain direction. And he said, fortunately, and he mentioned that he was able to have that freedom and didn't have the pressure of a studio. And you can really tell it's a real passion project for him. And it's a life's work that he's put into it. And so therefore, it doesn't feel like sort of a typical documentary.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it has real nice sort of stylistic choices that it goes down. Mm-hmm. It has a complete mix of sort of the images from when Baldwin was writing to completely contemporary images, and it feels really modern and up to date, even though it's words of a man that, you know, he actually died 30 years ago.
Yeah. In the 80s, I think.
Yeah.
No, most of his writing is still very much applies to race relations, not even just in the States sometimes, but mostly in America and what's happening over there right now. And I think that as a voice, I trusted him a lot more than I would have trusted, say, a civil rights activist or a politician for some reason. What did you think of him what did you think of his work? Which was the entire basis of the film.
I think Baldwin himself is so aware of being a witness and so aware of, and you know, during the film, and I mentioned it during the interview, that he's so aware of watching things and having this guilt of watching things and then moving on, that you trust him as a narrator because he's critical of himself.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the real strength of the film comes from. Baldwin is so aware of his position in the world and his position of where he is, and so passionate about where he wants to go, and he's so articulate. During the film, I noticed the stylistic choices that Raoul made was that he, whenever Baldwin's talking, there's hardly ever music over the top of it. There's often not images. Often he focuses the camera on these sort of old interviews that he's been given. But it never feels dull. His face lights up when he's talking about when Baldwin's talking about different issues, and it feels so contemporary because of that. Because you see the passion of the man, the words you're hearing, and that's where I think Samuel L. Jackson does a really great job as the narrator of the film and bringing the words to life.
Yeah, Samuel L. Jackson. I think we talked about this before. We were struggling to remember that he was actually the narrator because he doesn't just do voiceovers. Now in documentaries, you get an up-and-coming celebrity to voiceover whatever social, political kind of documentary you have. Here, it's not Samuel Jackson is not just lending his voice to it. He's giving a full-blown performance, a performance that I haven't... to a level that I haven't seen him give in a very, very long time, and he's not even on screen.
Yeah, but it's quite understated as well. That's the really important thing. And also, I was really worried when the film started and you saw a clip of Baldwin talking that we were then going to hear some sort of hammy impression mimicking him, trying to create the author's and the writer's voice. But we don't get that at all. We get a sincere narration that actually helps the film go along, and at times you don't even notice it. You particularly don't notice that it's Samuel Jackson.
No, absolutely not.
Like speaking.
I think understated is the perfect description for this voiceover, and it's so nostalgic. I think it contrasts very well with when you have Baldwin on the screen giving either in the debate in Cambridge, because there's two predominant clips. There's his debate in Cambridge against William F. Buckley Jr., and then there's his appearance in the Dick Cavett Show. And in both of those clips, he almost raises from his seat when, not provoked, but when given an argument. And his polemic is fantastic, and the prose is amazing. But then you have Samuel L. Jackson, whose tone is lower, it's calmer. So you have a very interesting contrast between two voices that are effectively coming from the same source.
Well, I think that's why the documentary is then able to put images over the narration, and you're able to concentrate on both, because there is this understatement and the images complement what's being said by Baldwin himself. And actually it would have taken away from the interviews if it had cut to loads of different images while Baldwin himself is talking, because you want to see him nearly rising from his seat and getting angry, and he has this sort of control about him when he's being challenged. There's one scene in particular where someone comes out and directly challenges him, another guest on a chat show.
That scene is fantastic.
But what Raoul Peck does is he holds the camera on that scene and doesn't try and cut away to other stuff going on. He lets that scene play out and then moves on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And I think the timing of this film is beautiful for that reason.
Yeah. And that scene, obviously I had to stop and replay it in my head over and over and over again, because this is James Baldwin belongs to that school of, don't really want to say orators, because he doesn't really do that on a public forum. He's a born debater. He doesn't have the ideals and the orating skills of somebody like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or Medgar Evers, he holds his own in pretty every single time I saw clips of him. I was hooked on every single word he was saying, and he manages to communicate his ideas and his ideology, very clearly from the beginning. And he says Malcolm X may have these views on white people. Martin Luther King has this view on white people. Medgar Evers has this. I do not hate the white man, but I have my problems with him. And then it kind of shoots off from there.
Well, I think that comes from, during the interview it mentions, Raoul, and you don't see this in the documentary, mentions Baldwin as sort of a young preacher, and mentions the fact that he gets away and moves away from America, and the importance of that, and that how that gives him a voice, and how actually I think Baldwin is really interesting. During the beginning of the film, it says there's sort of three extraordinary men that get assassinated. But this film really has four extraordinary men. The four extraordinary men. James Baldwin is one of those men.
Absolutely.
And should now be seen, I think, probably in those regards.
Yeah.
And be held up. And to, when you hear Raoul Peck talk about this passion project and this film, it makes you realise how important James Baldwin is. And if people are listening and don't know who James Baldwin is or haven't read any of his stuff, Raoul gave a recommendation during the interview.
Yeah.
But watch this film, because you will get an understanding of how crucial he is to sort of the experience of America at the time for him.
It's amazing how history always remembers what people are witnessing rather than the witnesses themselves. And he is very much a part of that. And I think it's also another wonderful reason to go and see this film is its use of Baldwin's experiences while going to the cinema forming initial opinions about white people, which I think will lead to a broader discussion, hopefully, with all of you after you see it. But Baldwin remembers going to the movies when he was younger and seeing movies like Stagecoach from the 1930s and Dance Fools Dance with Joan Crawford. And it's heroes like, it's an entire chapter in the film where he is in search of heroes.
Yeah.
I think that's a very interesting theme to have in I Am Not Your Negro, because in his during his search for heroes, at some point Baldwin realizes that he is a black man in America.
Yep.
Therefore, people like John Wayne will never, they never would support him on camera.
Yeah, John Wayne killing the Indians, he says, is like John Wayne killing him.
Exactly.
And that's the comparison he makes.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting because at some point he also references a film where you have Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis, who are two escaped convicts and are about to jump on the train to their freedom. And freedom means very different things to Tony Curtis, the white escapee, and Sidney Poitier, the black man.
Yeah.
And at some point, Tony Curtis slips and falls, and Poitier follows him. And in that tiny scene of that film, all of a sudden, Baldwin goes, white people were cheering for Sidney Poitier for going after Curtis. Black people, on the other hand, could not understand Poitier's decision,
yes,
to go after him, because it means slavery, imprisonment, and freedom mean very different things to these two people, these two races.
I think there are so many things you can talk about with this film. And,
yeah.
And there are so many... I think you could probably watch it 10 times and come out feeling completely different about different issues. And I think it makes you really aware of your own sort of opinions and where you're coming from and inadequacies and things like that. And I think that's the real strength of the film. And yet it's only 90 minutes long.
Yeah.
But the way it's chaptered and the way it uses Baldwin's voice throughout and the interviews throughout, I think gives it a real pace and keeps you thinking throughout. That at the end of the film, I sat there for about 10, 15 minutes and couldn't move because I had so many thoughts going on in my head. I thought, well, there's this. Oh, but then I remember this bit. And it's even as you're talking about it, and I'm sure when people come out and they've seen it with their friends or whoever, they come out and want to talk about it like this and want to have these big discussions and these big debates. And I think that's really why this film's been made, to get people talking, get people thinking about these issues in a modern context. And that's why the contemporary images are so crucial to this whole film.
Yes.
And actually show, in some ways, the film shows where we come from.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
But in other ways, it shows how America in particular hasn't necessarily moved on. And I think that's so important.
Yeah. One final thought as well is this film may seem like it is quite pessimistic. It doesn't really instill you with a sense of pride or anything, but it does instill you with a sense of hope, and it does try and inspire you and inspire people to come out with different opinions and even re-examine their views on race relations. So I think it's a must see.
Yeah,
definitely.
And that's out in cinemas today, and I know there's also some special events going on and things like that, so if you can try and check them out and see what's going on, because I know there's such discussion around this film, there's lots of panel discussions and things like that. We are now going to move on to our second film and interview, and I'm going to let Sam introduce this.
Hi, sorry I'm a bit hay fevery.
Oh,
so I'm a little
no.
bit, I'll be a bit sniffly. I'll try not to. So Raw is a new French, well, we use the word horror, but we'll talk more about why that might not be the best word to use in a bit. It's a new film by French director Julia de Cornel, very early in her career, and this is about a young vegetarian called Justine, who goes to veterinary university in France, where after a kind of really brutal sort of hazing ritual, where the students are forced to eat raw animal meat, she develops a taste for meat for the first time in her life, and eventually moves on to things other than animals. Let's just say that. Yeah, this film's attracted some, not controversy, but at its premiere in, I believe it was Toronto, two people fainted while watching this film. So it's kind of garnered this sort of word of mouth that this is the film that people are fainting when watching. And I spoke to the writer and director, Julia de Cornel, a few weeks ago in London, and we talked about whether the film is a horror film or not. We talked about this whole narrative about people fainting and watching it, amongst many other things. So enjoy. Okay, and we're now delighted to be joined by writer and director of Raw, Julia de Cornel. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So I guess, where did the idea for Raw come from? Be the first question.
Why is it the first question? Yeah, but why is it
the why is it the first question? Gives a bit of background, I suppose. And I mean, you know, it's such a unique story. I just want to know what kind of mind came up with that.
What kind of mind? But then I would have to tell you about my childhood or something.
If you want to talk to me about your childhood, I'll happily listen.
No, but it's, you know, you don't come up, I mean, I personally did not come up with this like in the glimpse of an eye. It's like a continuous work around certain questions and around the bodies also, because I've been working around bodies for the transformations of bodies for a long time now, because I was already talking about this in my school shorts. It's a long time ago.
Okay.
And of course, cannibalism tackled the subject of bodies a lot, obviously, and about opening bodies and actually bodies digesting bodies. So it's all around that, you know.
Yeah.
And also the thing is that I think cannibalism, when you ask yourself the question, "What is it to be human?" which is the question that is at the center of everything I do. Talking about cannibalism is interesting because of all the taboos of humanity, so with murder and incest, cannibalism is the only one that is treated like it doesn't exist.
Mm.
In movies or in general, when we talk about it, there is something like we call cannibals monsters, or we would qualify them as inhuman. When you see most cannibal movies are about tribes that are seen as they, and they're an anonymous group. And it's like they're treated like aliens from outer space or zombies. Like they don't exist, basically,
sure.
Which is not the case with murderers, mm-hmm. or with, in fewer movies, perpetrators of incest.
Okay.
With murderers and perpetrators of incest in movies or in series, they're always seen as human beings, horrible human beings, but they're seen as human beings. It's not the case with cannibals. Why? I think it's an interesting question, right? This is what I told my producer. So why is it that we kick them out of humanity like this? Actually, I think now that the reason why we do is because it's too close to us. It's too close to us where, and that's why we want to see them from far. Because in our bodies, we are constantly reminded of, one, our animality, in our desires, in our impulses and stuff like that, and two, of our dangerosity. Example, when you try to bite someone for fun, if you want to try to bite the hand of someone. We used to do that a lot when we were kids.
Sure, yeah.
I haven't done it in a long time, but I remember the sensation that it felt, you know? Like, when you do that, you have this tickly sensation in the teeth.
Okay.
Because your body wants to go further. But your mind says no, because you know you're going to hurt that person and you don't want that. So you stop. But your body is clearly in contradiction. It's contradicting your mind.
Yeah.
He wants to go. And the fact that it's this impulse is in us, I think it's pretty scary, because somehow it's like your body is becoming autonomous. If your body is becoming autonomous, what does it make you as a human being?
Right, okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is where my story about bodies makes sense.
Yes, definitely.
You know?
I'm getting something now. So like this sort of
almost like a fight between your body and your mind. It's kind of tension.
Your animality and your humanity.
Yeah. Okay, so it's the tension there, that's where the raw is, essentially it comes from that kind of that
it
tension.
It came from that reasoning.
Okay. Mm. And you mentioned there that sort of cannibalism is this kind of almost unspoken about taboo. I mean, did you set out to really kind of break taboos with this film and really...
Well, it's not about breaking taboos. It's for me, as long as my main questioning again is what is it to be human, then I'm not going to repress the dark side of humanity.
Mm.
And if I had only a Disney version of life in my head, I probably would not make films.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's not very interesting to me.
No.
And I really don't think that anyone can grow up by repressing a part of them. And society certainly can't either.
Yeah.
So I think it's like by accepting our humanity in its totality that you can grow up.
Mm, okay.
And that's why I think it's interesting also to question its edges.
Yeah, mm. Okay. So at the film's premiere in Toronto, there was this kind of word began to spread of this film that was making people faint and causing this really kind of physical reaction. I mean, what were your thoughts on that when you started to hear these kind of rumours and the way the film's being talked about, that it's kind of having this physical effect on people?
Many things. One, the thing with the two people who fainted is true, because I say
yeah.
it because people think it was planted, but it was not. I was there. What became something else is afterwards. Afterwards, it snowballed on the internet that my movie was like the goriest movie ever made.
Mm.
Which is amazing, because clearly people who write this have never seen a movie in their lives, because they can at least cite at least 100
yeah.
movies that are gorier than mine. And that it was, yeah, so, you know, the whole barf bag thing. And like, honestly, for me, it's, I mean, as a director, there is something that's a bit heartbreaking there, because it doesn't do justice to my movie. My movie is really not a barf fest. It's not a torture porn. It's
no.
not a shocker. There are three scenes that are hard to watch. So being reduced to a bar fest is a bit, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't think that all publicity is good publicity. I really don't think that. But that, again, as a director, I'm saying this. So that's my reaction. And the second thing is that I think it's a shame, because some people might be scared to go see the movie where they actually could handle it.
Yeah.
And actually, I've met a lot of people from audiences after Q&A telling me I was afraid to see it, but actually, I really loved the movie. I really did not expect that, and I completely watched everything, you know?
Yeah.
So, and other people who actually want to see a torture porn and to see a gore fest are going to be disappointed, because this is what my movie is not.
Certainly. Okay.
So, no one wins.
No. And so the film's lead actress, Garance Millier, you've worked with her before.
Can you repeat her name just for me?
I knew I'd get it wrong. Garance Marillier?
Oh, good.
Marillier?
No,
Marillier.
Well, perfect.
Okay. What kind of experience was it working with her on this film? With someone you've known for so long now.
Time. With Garance, we know each other very well.
Okay.
In real life, because she started on my first short when she was 12. Which was already a crossover implying some body horror. And but it was more towards comedy. It was a bit lighter. But still crossover with comedy, personal drama, and body horror, just in the same vein. Afterwards, she was in my TV feature. And so now this one. So the thing is that since we've worked a lot together, we've established on set a very big... amount of trust, which is amazing, because when you have scenes that are very physical and indeed that are hard for her and for me to shoot, when you trust each other, you know that you can set ambitions very high and that you can constantly push each other, you know, further, and somehow you're still in a security or in a safety zone, because she knows that I would never like do anything to take her out of the safety zone without telling her,
sure.
You know, and I know that she can go very, very far, and I know I can take her very, very far. So you have really this thing that we can really like go hand in hand, taking risks, but that risks that are we, yeah, that we're together, you know. We're,
yeah.
That's really good. It really means that we can really go have high ambitions for the scenes, which is really nice. And I think it's mainly because we've known each other for a long time. It's not something that just happens like this. It's something that is really crafted in time, you know. Okay. And so that's it.
Okay. So there's people are talking about the kind of more the cannibal elements of the film a lot. But something that I found just as hard to watch was this kind of the peer pressure element of the film and the sort of the brutality of Justine's first week of being a student. I mean, how was your first year as a student in compared to...
Oh, man, I was in a hippie school. Film school is hippie school. It was super cool.
So there was none of this kind of raiding the rooms, throwing stuff out the window?
No.
It was a bit more relaxed?
I have imagination.
Okay, excellent. Okay. So the word feminist has been used a lot to describe this film. I was wondering, do you view it yourself as a feminist film?
But of course.
Okay. For what reasons?
Well, for many reasons, but for the first reason is that as a woman I would be shitting against my own side if I said I wasn't a feminist, right?
Okay.
So and so obviously it shows in my movie because I did it. I think the main thing is that when I decided that my character was gonna be female, which was not always the case, because as a screenwriter, I consider that I could project myself in any kind of characters. Of course, if some men can write some women parts, some women can surely write some men parts.
Yeah.
So at one point, I like, you know, to project myself in all the possibilities of my movie. So I thought, what age is it? What gender is it? What background does he or she have and stuff like that? And I was thinking, once I decided that it was gonna, you know, take place like in the post-teen years or pre-adult years and stuff like that, with that was implying a discovery of sexuality at this age roughly, I decided I think I have more to defend if I take a female character over a male character, because I do think that the way female sexuality is portrayed nowadays on screens is never about sexuality, actually. It's always very cerebral in the projection of the after. Did I make the good choice? Am I going to pass for a slut? Is he going to call me back? Things like that. And this in a very victimized way, if you wish, and passive. I don't like that, because for me this is nothing about sex. There is nothing about sexuality for me. For me, sexuality is the body and the climax. It's your body aiming at climax.
Yeah.
This is what it is for all of us. Why would we deny that? This is what sexuality is. And I'm thinking it's funny, because it's not something I've seen a lot in the birth of sexuality in female characters. So I wanted to portray some sexuality that was unapologetic and fully anchored in its own body and its own impulses, its own desires. Without thinking of the after, you know? And I think you start thinking of the after if you feel shame, but since she doesn't feel shame, she's not thinking about the after.
Yeah.
Right? She's just doing it. I think it was important to... I mean, for me, it was important to portray female sexuality like that. The second thing is that I think in terms of body again, I really tried to film the female body in a way that it's taken outside of its niche, and that it's universal, and that it can be relatable for everyone. Because most of the time I notice that male characters are, it's granted that they're relatable by everyone, but not female characters. When you write female characters, most of the time you're like, yeah, but you know, maybe it's only women that can understand, you know, and I think that's bullshit. As an audience and as a filmmaker, we should all be able to relate to any character. If I want you to love a giant rat, I should first love the giant rat, and then you should love the giant rat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that for me is, and I don't understand why it's still the case with female. But so my strategy with this, and it's again about the bodies, is that I wanted to tackle the triviality of her physicality, and to make it a relatable body in its intimacy, like its fluids, it's gases, it's all these things like blood and puke and pee and everything that we find gross, but that in the end are endearing because we all have that. Mm. You know, we all have hair and stuff like that. And I think for me, this was a way to bring her as a female character to universality.
Okay, great. And I can see by your T-shirt, you're wearing an Edgar Allan Poe T-shirt, so I'm going to take it you're a horror fan in general?
Yes, but yeah. My movie is not a horror movie, but I am a horror fan.
So, okay, you would say you would distance your film from the horror genre then?
But do you find it scary?
I don't know about scary, but yeah, I would
it's
say...
disturbing.
Yeah, maybe disturbing.
For me, a horror movie is... The main thing is, like, if I write a horror movie, I think I would try to scare people. I mean,
okay.
As an audience, as a horror fan, this is what I seek.
Yeah.
That's why I'm saying that.
Okay. Throughout horror, other horror films, I've noticed that sort of they're sometimes used to sort of tell stories of like female coming of age, like Carrie, The Exorcist, and then last year we had The Witch. And I was going to ask if maybe you saw Raw as in sort of connection with those films.
Yeah, I mean, different ways. It's not the same. But,
yeah.
But Carrie, I did a reference to the movie in my movie just because I thought that everyone who has just seen a few movies in their life would anticipate, you know, this reference to happen because of the premise of the movie. So I thought I'm gonna do it myself.
Yeah.
Blood of Shower, so that it's a wink, you know, and
sure.
Then we can move on. But it's just Carrie is not necessarily my favorite movie ever, even though I like it. But
yeah.
For me, it's a supernatural movie, so it's not connected to my movie. For me, what's important with my movie is that there is absolutely no supernatural in it,
no.
And we're talking about real people.
Yeah.
The thing with The Witch, I love The Witch, I think, by the way, it's brilliant. It's really, again, I wouldn't call it a horror movie, personally.
Okay, okay.
A genre movie, for sure.
Yeah.
But not a horror movie. But it's definitely a family drama.
Mm.
I mean, personal identity and family drama. And very, very well portrayed. I do relate to this movie, but to this generation, more generally. That is now trying to like me, I think, because that's what I try to do as well, to break down the boundaries between auteur and genre.
Okay.
Because, you know, usually people tend to think that genre movies or horror movies are not deep, you know, when
yeah.
they're just like, flicks,
yeah.
if you wish. I do believe that a lot of horror movies are incredibly deep and that I aim to do that. And I do feel that there is a generation with the guy who did The Witch, the guy who did Fellows, with Annalilim, Amirpour, Karim Kuzama,
yeah.
Jennifer Bent, so many that I forget about, and I'm sorry, Lucila Diaryovich in France, that there are people who believe in genre as a legitimate way of expression and a smart one and a deep one, and I really, really hope that, again, as usual, that this is not a trend and that we'll see more and more of these directors and other directors.
Excellent. Judith Cornell, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. Something really interesting she said in the interview was that she didn't consider Raw a horror film because it's not, for her, she said, it's not supernatural, there are no jump scares, and the sort of gory aspects and the cannibal aspects aren't there to be sensationalised.
Mm.
And I think to an extent I agree that it's not there to make people feel sick. It's not there to scare people. It's not there to make people go, oh, God, like in the way that Hostel is or
yeah.
Saw is. But at the same time, I would consider it a horror. I think that it's not a clear-cut horror. It's definitely... Because there is, you can't escape the whole, it is disgusting at times,
yeah.
the cannibal stuff.
Well,
what do you think that adds to the film? Why do you think that's in there?
Well, I think it's a quite difficult film to read because it's not really clear why this happens to
yeah.
her. It's not like it, I think some people will go and see this film and expect it to be some sort of curse or some sort of infection
yeah.
or that she's turning into a zombie or a werewolf or something, and it's not that. It's just about... I mean, you could read it as sort of going to university and your personality changing in dramatic ways
right. yeah.
and
yeah.
exploring your body, exploring the physicality that you haven't been able to do when you live at home with your parents, things like that. I think it could be I mean, there's definitely a feminist vein through this film, mm-hmm. and De Corna said so herself. The sort of female taking control of her body, I think, is definitely there in the film. But at the same time, you know, it is unsettling at times. And the music's really great and definitely feels like it's from a horror film. And I think just in the way the film's been marketed, I think it's absolutely been marketed as a horror film.
Yeah.
But it's not the kind of horror film that people who saw, I don't know, The Conjuring 2 would necessarily run out and see. This is more for fans of The Witch or fans of It Follows. And I'll probably bring up The Witch a few times in this review because it's out roughly at the same time of year as The Witch. I think they're kind of going for that kind of market. And I think that's a really good decision because this is the latest in a long line of because kind of art house horror films. So we kind of, a little bit, we had it earlier, a few years ago, It Follows. Last year we had The Witch and Goodbye Mummy.
There seems to be a renaissance with that.
Definitely. And we, Eyes of My Mother is a film coming out in a few months' time that seems to kind of fit in that vein of this kind of pseudo-feminist art house horror. And it's a really interesting movement, and I'm really excited to see where it goes. And Raw is, I think, a really nice addition to that. So if you are squeamish, there is definitely stuff there that is going to make you feel uneasy.
Mm-hmm.
But don't think of this as any kind of torture porn, because I mean sometimes the cannibal scenes. There's one scene in particular that is the scene that made people faint, and I did go, ooh, in my seat.
Does it feel gratuitous at all?
No, it never feels gratuitous. And at times...
Did you make that noise?
I did.
Right, okay.
I think a lot of people went, shh.
Yeah, I bet.
Sometimes it is there to be a bit disturbing and unsettling. Sometimes I think it's almost played for laughs at times.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of... ridiculousness of it and how this is so weird that this is happening and no one seems to be reacting in a way that you'd think people would react to that. and other times it's kind of very matter of fact that this is happening. So it has a very interesting tone that is maybe the reason why De Corna doesn't outwardly say this is definitely a horror film because it's not there to scare people as such. Something that's really interesting. Something else that I really was kind of surprised at is I think the majority of the film is that the first week of uni for Justine, and it looks like a really, really tough place to be. So there's this kind of the hazing goes on, and like the older students kind of in the earlier scenes, there's kind of like a raid from the older students that burst in, take all the possessions, and drag them in like in their underwear to this nightclub. And they have to stay there the whole night. And just things like that happen. And it's kind of like, you know, you hear these legendary stories about sports teams. What are they called? The
initiations.
Initiations, yeah. It's playing with that. And
Sam, you know, we did initiations when the podcast first started. We had to sit in the radio studio and review every Nicolas Cage film.
Including what was the latest one, Ursie?
You know what? I do not know the title, but I'm going straight to HMV.
Let's not mention it.
He doesn't want
to. I mean, it is slightly exaggerated, that hazing stuff, but it definitely rang true from the stories I've read and the things I've seen, and it is quite horrible. And because she's a slightly shyer girl, she doesn't really like going out so much, the lead character. So that the horror almost comes from that as much as it does the cannibal stuff for me. And in a way, her turning into sort of a cannibal is almost her empowering herself against this kind of wave of peer pressure. So the lead actress is Garance Merillier. I think I've pronounced that right. She's absolutely fantastic, and she's pretty much not just in every scene, but almost in every single shot in the way that sort of Mia Farrow in Rosemary's Baby is in every single corner of that film. That's not an easy thing for a young actress to do, I think, especially in a film of this nature. So I think full props to her. She really delivered that.
Yeah. As you were reviewing this film, I had so many titles pop into my head. So this movie does borrow a lot from classic horror cinema, because I had in my head Repulsion, for example, and Rosemary's Baby, And then I had really classic French horror film cinema in my head, like Jacques Tourneur's The Cat People,
right,
where a woman actually turns into a panther. And does Rob borrow from these kind of traditions?
I think not quite.
Okay.
I think, as De Connor said in the interview, she's, for her, it's not necessarily a horror film as such. But like I said, for me, there are times when I felt like I was watching a horror film. So it's a difficult thing to... Yeah. But yeah, I definitely guess Repulsion was definitely there for me. And there's even a sort of Ginger Snaps. Have you seen Ginger
Snaps?
Are they sisters in Ginger Snaps?
They are, yeah. Werewolves,
yeah. And there's a really interesting relationship between the lead character and her sister in the film that reminded me a lot of Ginger Snaps.
Okay.
So I think the references are there, but I think they're more that like us as horror fans have thrown them onto the film rather than De Cornell put them in there. There's a lot of Carrie as well. There's a lot of blood-soaked young women in the film, and immediately you think of Carrie, mm-hmm. as she said in the interview. So yeah, that is out today, April 7th. I think it's going to get a fairly good release. It's going for that same audience as The Witch, which actually did really well considering its budget. So do check out Raw. I'd really enjoyed the film a lot. If I maybe had one slight criticism, it would perhaps be that the ending didn't quite pack the punch I think it's intended to,
mm-hmm.
but the rest of the it's a good ending still, and I think the rest of the film is good enough that didn't mar the experience in any way. Cool. So that's Raw.
Excellent. Cheers for that.
Thank you.
We're two reviews down, two interviews down, and now we're going to move on to our preview, and Ursi is going to lead this. We are going to be talking about Neruda, which is the new Pablo Larraín film. Ursi, tell us a bit about it.
All right, so Neruda stars Gael García Bernal and Luis Gnecco. Bernal plays a policeman called Oscar Paluchonot, who is charged with tracking down Pablo Neruda, who has just been ousted from the government of Chile, and is now living in exile and is toying with his policeman in a cat-and-mouse kind of situation. And from Larraín's own words, this is not your real biopic. This is not... Don't expect a history lesson from Neruda, because the titular character himself is a poet, and therefore this film is, in effect, a false documentary. So it bases a lot of his... a lot of the scenes are based on Neruda's own prose. And yeah, it looks like a great film. And Larraín, it's not Larraín's first foray into Chilean history, as he's quite involved. His first three films, barring his actual first one, Huga, were Tony Manero, Postmortem, and No, which were all about the Pinochet dictatorship. And then No is the end of that. I mean, it's Larraín. You must have seen some of his work, mostly Jackie, starring Natalie Portman.
Yeah, that was a big release early this year. And we, if you do want to listen back, we did a whole podcast about it.
Yeah.
And really interesting film, really.
Absolutely.
And I think... always with Larraín, you get really interesting casting as well, like in terms of he selects the right people for the right roles, and I think a lot of directors don't seem to do that necessarily all the time, and I think he definitely does that.
Yeah. Although I would say as well, Jackie is his first English language film, so previously he kind of stuck to his native country, and he wants to narrate the history of Chile during the... Neruda takes place in the 40s, and then the Pinochet... No to Pinochet trilogy, I would say, takes place in... the 70s? Yes. Let's go with that. Forgive me if my history is a bit hazy there. And so he wants to present the history of his country in a kind of novel and really interesting way, and I think Neruda is definitely a good addition to this objective, being a biopic that's based on poetry rather than historical fact. So yeah, it's on Curzon Home Cinema as of today, and I thoroughly recommend it.
Lovely. So that's Neruda, as Ursie said, it's out on Curzon Home Cinema today. Please do check it out. Curzon Home Cinema recommends. What have we got this week?
Well, there's the Pablo Larraín collection. So this has Fuga, Tony Manero, Postmortem, No, Gloria, The Club, Nasty Baby, and Neruda.
That is a lot.
Yeah, check through his back catalogue. His next film, by the way, is a drama called The True American, starring Tom Hardy, about Islamophobia following 9/11.
Oh, is he confirmed to do that now?
Yeah, according to an online source.
I didn't know that he was signed up to that.
Yeah, it was originally Catherine Bigelow.
That's great.
But Tom Hardy's stayed with it. Tom Hardy's been attached to this since 2014.
Okay, but someone else has.
And now Pablo Larraín is tackling that. And I think it's quite interesting that he's so after he did Jackie, and now he's doing this, he's kind of really going through the Americana, American political scene, but hopefully not just doing the kind of America stuff we've seen for filmmakers.
Well, I think interestingly with Jackie, it's interesting comparing it to something like I Am Not Your Negro, in terms of Raoul Peck moved away from America. He was not originally from America, the director, and then came back and moved away and then came back. And I think it's interesting having this perspective of sort of American people, particularly with Jackie being such an iconic image and an iconic woman, and sort of an American sweetheart in many ways. I think it's really fascinating having directors not directly from America directing these films, because I think they bring a different perspective, and they bring something different to it. And
it's great
to see him doing something like Neruda, and still keeping what sort of made him what he is today, I guess, in many ways. So you had a couple of films you wanted to recommend from the collection?
From the collection, Tony Manero is an excellent introduction to Larraín's filmmaking. I find it's about a man in the middle of the Pinochet dictatorship who competes in Tony Manero lookalike contests. So a lot of Bee Gees in the middle of the Pinochet dictatorship, which is a very unsettling sight. And most recently, I also watched Postmortem, which is a love story, a very unconventional love story, about a civil servant at the morgue who is in love with a cabaret dancer. And he expresses his love, and then the day after is the Pinochet coup, and he has to deal with the amount of dead bodies coming into the morgue. This cabaret dancer whose whole family has been kidnapped by the military junta, and it's fantastic. By the end of this movie, I was watching with my mouth wide open, at a complete disbelief of what I was actually looking at, because it's just masterclass filmmaking from Larraín.
Excellent. Finally, from Curzon Home Cinema, I recommend, if you've never been on Curzon Home Cinema, because we mention it every week, but if you've never been on there and just want to have a look around, there is actually a welcome collection on there. All you need to do is sign up. You get offered one of the films to rent. I'd recommend Cartel Land. Really interesting. Give it a watch. Try Home Cinema. You can try it on laptops, smart TVs. I think you can probably tablets. You can probably even get it on your phone, I imagine. So yeah, definitely try out Curzon Home Cinema. See what it's like. This week in cinemas, we've got Terrence Davis's new film, A Quiet Passion, surrounding Emily Dickinson, and it stars Cynthia Nixon in maybe a career, you know, changing role. I didn't even recognise her.
Miranda, she was from Sex and the City.
She was Miranda from Sex and the City. Yeah. Thanks for clearing that up, Sam.
I'll also quickly plug on Curzon Home Cinema. Graduation is up there.
Oh, yeah.
And in last week's podcast, we had an interview with the film's writer, director and producer, Christian Mungiu, So do check that out.
Yeah, graduation. Listen back to that as well. It's really interesting. Excellent. So that is all we have time for from this absolutely That's all we've got time for from that absolutely... It's got dark outside since we've been recording. It's goodbye from First Name Only Sam.
Goodbye, First Name Only Harry.
It's goodbye from First Name Only Ursi.
Goodbye to both of you.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.